All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's Tuesday, March 2nd, and that's as much as I can turn the microphone down. We might have to do some electronics in that cabinet to turn it down a little bit more. Anyway, we have a test scheduled for 1 week from today, and there were some questions of Chapter 9 is going to be on the test. Well, I would really like it to be on the test, but I won't be able to lecture on Chapter 9 before the test, so my guess is that we'll probably postpone Chapter 9 to the next test. So what's going to be on exam number 2 are Chapters 4, 5, and 7, right? 4, 5, and 7. Okay, thanks so much. All right, so we're not quite done with Chapter 7 yet. And sometime in lab, you guys are going to have to draw something that we're going to cover, and I just had a great idea about this morning, so I didn't let the lab instructors know, or you guys know, so I'm going to send you an email. But the figure that you're going to have to draw, and not just label like you have in your notes, is figure 7.13, which is an action potential. So we're going to go over that today. I'm sure you're going to go over that in lab, but that I want you at least to be able to draw from memory and on a blank piece of paper. You don't have to do that right now. That will help you a lot for the test. All right, and the only other announcement I have is that there's no SI today. So hopefully there'll be SI on Thursday, but I'll let you know. I presume Thursday is fine. All right, so last time we were talking about a special membrane protein that allows charge particles to move across the membrane. So don't forget, why can't charged molecules move across the plasma membrane? Because charged molecules are polar or hydrophilic, and the inner membrane is hydrophobic, right? So it's going to exclude polar molecules. All right, but nonetheless, polar molecules do move across the membrane, changing the electrical properties of the cell through what we call channels. Some channels are open all the time, most channels are closed all the time, but they can be triggered into opening under certain kinds of circumstances. So we see the figure right here of a membrane channel that is normally closed, and with the proper kind of stimulation, we're going to talk about what can open up a membrane channel. It opens up, and ions can move through this particular channel, and this particular one even has a special inactivation gate. So after it opens, this little ball right here can actually plug up the channel. And even though the channel is open, ions can't move across because it has that little plug in there. And that little plug is what we call an inactivation gate. So we need to relate this to some of the physiology of a neuron as well, which is what we're going to do today. But try to refer to this figure right here. So this is a channel. Okay. So we looked at resting membrane potentials, and a resting membrane potential just has a constant voltage on the inside of the cell compared to the outside of the cell. So if we were going to draw a resting membrane potential out, I think I'm going to stop talking just a little bit so I don't. We have to plot what? Voltage versus time. All right, now how would you draw in a resting membrane potential on that graph? What's the vertical axis going to be labeled in? Okay, minus 70 what? Yeah, millivolts. So we're going to put right in parentheses right here, millivolts. And what is that signal going to look like versus time? If it's a resting membrane potential, nothing's happening to the cell. So it's just going to be a constant, right? And that cell is still nice and alive even though nothing is happening. If that cell is dead, guess what happens to that voltage? It goes to zero. Okay? So this is what we call RMP right here. Just a resting membrane potential. The voltage is not changing. All right, an action potential is a little bit different beast. So when you see that term action potential, potential means what? Voltage, right? There's going to be a separation of charge across the membrane. But what does this term, what does that term mean to you? Action. something's happening, something's changing. So the voltage is actually changing across the cell membrane. And action potentials are due to special membrane proteins that we call voltage-gated channels. So they're going to be similar to this kind of guy right here, but what changes the state of this particular protein is just the voltage across the membrane. So as the voltage changes, this gate can either open or close, or it can become inactivated, just depending on the voltage. Because what can you tell me about positive and negative charges? Yeah, opposite charges attract, and proteins have charges on them, so if we change the charge inside the cell, that's going to push and pull on the molecule, turn it, cause it to twist or somehow move a little bit differently. And so the voltage across the membrane can get those gates to open or close. Right, so therefore we call those a voltage-gated channel. Okay, so this is the diagram that I want you to draw just from memory. This is an action potential. This is a plot of membrane potential in millivolts versus time in milliseconds, so it's pretty fast. All right, and what do we have here at minus 70? What would you label that? That would be RMP, right? And if we don't stimulate the cell is just going to stay right at RMP and live a very happy life. All right, but we can excite this particular cell. We can stimulate it, and we stimulate it by injecting some kind of positive ion inside the cell, change the electrical property of the cell so it becomes less negative or, more positive. All right, so if we allow positive ions to enter this cell, what happens to the resting membrane potential? If positive ions go in, what happens? Well, it's negative on the inside, and if we add positive ions, then that negative area inside the cell, it goes to zero. Okay, so what do we call it when resting membrane potential goes from a big minus number up to zero? That was a definition. Okay, depolarization. The cell is depolarizing. All right, but at this particular point, an action potential has not started yet. All right, so this depolarization right here, we just call a stimulus. All right, so we're stimulating the cell by allowing positive charges to enter the cell. And then, right at this point right here, at about minus 60 millivolts, there is a membrane protein that changes state, namely this kind of protein right here. Normally, this sodium channel is closed, but at minus 60 millivolts, there's enough pulling and pulling on this particular protein that the sodium channel just pops open. All right? So now sodium can move across the membrane, and what you should try to picture in your mind is which way is sodium going to move? Where is sodium at a high concentration? Outside the cell and low inside. So by the concentration gradient, will sodium want to move inside the cell? Yeah. And what about due to the electrical gradient? Will that pull sodium in or exclude sodium? That will pull it in as well, right? So there is a chemical gradient, and the electrical gradient is a big motive force for drawing sodium inside the cell. So this channel opens up. So as sodium enters the cell, as sodium enters the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? What kind of charge does sodium have? It has a positive charge, right? So that neutralizes the negative charge inside the cell, and we can measure this with a nice oscilloscope or multimeter, and so we see a rapid change in the membrane potential due to sodium entering the cell. And what can you tell me about diffusion? How does diffusion go? What controls diffusion? Concentration gradient, right? So initially here is where we have a big concentration gradient, so the motion of sodium is extremely fast, right? And as the concentration gradient disappears and the motion of sodium into the cell, or we could call that a current, starts to slow down as a result of that. All right, so an action potential has two parts to it that we see with this yellow area versus this blue area right here. All right, the yellow area is what we call depolarization. All right, action potential has two phases. Depolarization, and that is due to an ion. What ion? Sodium. And which way is, it's not just sodium being there, it's sodium in motion. Which way is sodium moving? inside the cell. So that is just a classic definition of depolarization of an action potential. Okay, so right at this level right here, the stimulus has to reach threshold before there are sufficient sodium channels that open up to cause this first phase of an action potential. Right, and these membrane proteins won't open up, these voltage-gated channels won't open up until this voltage is reached, which we call the threshold voltage. Now there's a positive feedback mechanism that starts up with this action potential, at least this first phase of the action potential. We said that these channels open up right here based on what kind of phenomena? What's causing these channels to open up? Yeah, the charge across the membrane, right? And as the stimulus proceeds, right, the cell depolarizes. When it reaches threshold, some of these gates open up, and then more sodium rushes into the cell, which causes more depolarization, which causes more voltage-gated channels to open up, which causes what? More sodium to enter the cell, which causes what? More channels to open up, right? So you have this big pulse of sodium entering the cell as a result of that. So that's a nice positive feedback mechanism. And what can you tell me about positive feedback mechanisms in general? Do they produce a normal healthy state or a disease state? Normally a disease state, but in this particular circumstance, that positive feedback is necessary to get that depolarization phase of an action potential working very rapidly. Okay. All right, so the stimulus is due to an injection of some kind of positive ions inside the cell. All right, and then when the cell reaches plus 30 millivolts right here, something happens that stops that sodium current right away. And that is this inactivation gate triggers. The inactivation gate plugs up the sodium channel even though it's still open, and that stops the sodium current. So sodium cannot enter the cell anymore. So if sodium can't enter the cell, all right, the voltage is not going to change. But now there is a second voltage-gated protein that has become activated, and it is one specific for what ion? It's potassium. All right, so now we have a potassium that opens up, potassium channel that opens up, and which way is potassium going to want to go? Well, now the inside of the cell is positive, so it's more negative outside the cell. That's going to draw potassium to the extracellular space, right? And what about the concentration gradient? Which way is the concentration gradient facing for potassium? Where is it high? It's high inside, low outside. Again, that's going to draw potassium outside the cell. And as these charged particles leave the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? It starts to drop. It starts to go negative again. Right, and here we can see it going back down toward threshold, right, and even going down to resting membrane potential because potassium is leaving the cell, and that's what we call repolarization. All right, so you should know the two phases of an action potential, depolarization, repolarization. Depolarization is due to sodium entering the cell. Repolarization is due to potassium leaving the cell. And they're due to what kind of membrane protein? Because these ions can't go across the plasma membrane unless they have what? Some kind of channel. And these channels are controlled by the voltage across the cell membrane. So we call these voltage-gated channels. Okay. And the potassium channel and the sodium channel get activated at the exact same time. When does that voltage-gated sodium channel, or when do some of them become activated? You should be able to speak about that. When does this voltage-gated sodium channel in a neuron become activated? When the threshold is reached, right here. Okay? Sodium channels are fast-acting, so as soon as threshold is reached, they open up. The same thing for potassium. As soon as threshold is reached, the potassium channels start to open up. But guess what? They're slow. So even though they have the signal, they want to change state, they're just sluggish. It takes them a little while to get going. All right, so that's why the second phase of the action potential is controlled by the potassium voltage-gated channels because they're slow to open up, even though they get triggered at the exact same time. All right, and here's kind of a rule. If something can be activated very quickly, the duration of action typically is very short. All right, if something takes a long time to develop, its action lasts for a relatively long time. All right, so when you get into pharmacology, you'll probably notice that effect. There are certain barbiturates that are fast-acting, but the advantage of a fast-acting barbiturate is that it doesn't last very long. All right, a long-acting barbiturate, right, takes a long time to develop inside the body, right, but it will persist for a long period of time. The same thing for these particular channels right here. The fast ones, which one are the fast ones? Well, what are the two? What are the two voltage-gated channels that we're talking about? Sodium and potassium. One is a fast-acting channel, which is sodium, so that governs depolarization, and the slower one is potassium, but it lasts for a little bit longer period of time, and because it stays open for a little bit longer period of time, look, we get a little overshoot right here. Right, so this area right here is what we call hyperpolarization. That's going to be important in terms of how the nervous system works, we'll talk about in just a little bit. And we get this little bit of overshoot because the potassium channels don't close very quickly. Right? They're slow to open up, but they're also slow to close. All right, and then eventually the membrane potential goes back to this dark line right here. What would you label this dark line right here? Yeah, that's RMP, right? Resting membrane potential. Okay. So don't forget about these positive feedback mechanisms that operate in this action potential right here. Okay, so I think I've talked about all of these things on these slides right here. All right, so depolarization and repolarization, the two phases of an action potential, occur only because of diffusion, right? They don't require any active transport. There are no ATP pumps on the membrane. They move just due to what? A concentration gradient and also the voltage across the membrane. All right, but then after the action potential passes, then you need that sodium-potassium pump to readjust the ion concentrations to get back to equilibrium. So sodium-potassium pump is necessary to set up an action potential, but not actually to drive it as it's existing. So here we have a nice figure in your textbook. All right, here we have RMP. We've got the two phases of an action potential. We've got depolarization and repolarization. And then justified in time, this is the figure, the one below it is what we really want to look at, is, so the time scale is the same. All right, the first one is what, just membrane potential in millivolts versus time. But the second graph is not a measure of voltage, but it is the permeability of ions versus time. And what are the two ions that we're interested in for an action potential? Sodium and potassium. All right, so I see two curves. I see one that starts right away, and then I see a second one. Which one starts right away? That's the sodium. Permeability changes because of those sodium voltage-gated channels. All right, so this is causing depolarization, and then that sodium current stops and starts to go to zero. So what happens right here at the peak of the sodium current? What do we got happening? Whoa, we got to go all the way back. What is this guy called? Maybe label it on your illustration. It's not labeled in this figure right here. It might not be labeled in your book. That would be a shame. That's called an inactivation gate, right? That's an inactivation gate. All right, so right at the peak of permeability of sodium, that inactivation gate closes. So what happens to the permeability of sodium? Goes to zero, right? It just crashes, right? And then when that inactivation gate closes, that occurs almost right at the peak opening of the potassium channels. So now potassium can leave the cell, leave the cell, and that causes what? Repolarization. All right, but again, these are slower kinds of channels, so this effect persists for a long period of time, causing this little negative area of this action potential underneath the resting membrane potential, which is what we call hyperpolarization. Now, interesting thing about action potentials is that that is how information is transmitted along a neuron over long distances. And who can tell me the three main parts of a neuron? Just by structure, the three main parts of a neuron. You got dendrites, you got soma, and you've got axon, right? So these voltage-gated channels are found exclusively on an axon of a neuron. They're not found on dendrites or the cell body, right? And these voltage-gated channels are necessary to start these action potentials, but also transmit an action potential down an axon. From, does anybody remember what the beginning part of an axon is called? It's right next to the axon hillock. That's the first place where we see voltage-gated channels. Okay, and that action potential can be transmitted all the way down an axon because the whole length of an axon has voltage-gated channels. And when you have an action potential in motion down an axon, that's what we call a nerve impulse. So an action potential in motion is a nerve impulse. And that's how information can be transmitted along a nerve, only as an action potential. All right, so here we see three action potentials, and we see four different levels of stimulation on this one particular nerve. Here we have a very weak stimulation, and is it producing an action potential? No. Now, how could you relate that to the figure that you have to draw? Why is this weak stimulus right here not producing an action potential? Because that particular stimulus has not reached threshold. Right? So here is a stimulus, and maybe it stopped right here. It didn't reach threshold, so therefore, those voltage-gated channels don't get opened up because it didn't reach threshold. All right, so now let's increase the stimulus a little bit. Maybe bring it to this level right here. Flip back to this slide. So here is still a pretty weak stimulus, so the length of that red arrow represents the strength or the amplitude of the stimulus. So now we made the stimulus a little bit greater, and guess what we can institute here? An action potential. And this part is called depolarization and repolarization. Here's the amplitude of an action potential, right? What's that, about 30 millivolts typically? All right, and then we let that nerve recover, and then at another point in time, we issue another stimulus to it. And what can you tell me about this third stimulus in terms of intensity? It's stronger, right? It's a little bit bigger in a stimulus. But now let's look at this action potential, right, produced by the third stimulus. Compare that with the first action potential. What's the difference? There's absolutely no difference. Look, the duration is exactly the same. The amplitude is exactly the same, right? So action potentials are all the same. And so, even if the axon hillock, an action potential has the same duration and amplitude, an action potential at the axon terminus has the same amplitude and duration as well. So, an action potential moving down an axon travels without decrement. It doesn't change. It has all the same properties at the cell body compared to the axon terminus. That's a pretty special circumstance. All right, so just to reinforce this point, let's come along with even a stronger stimulus after a period of rest. And what is that going to produce? An action potential. Why does it produce an action potential? Because it reaches threshold that produces an action potential. And what can you tell me about this third action potential to any of these previous ones? They're exactly the same, right? So all action potentials have the same amplitude, same duration. Okay, everything about them is the same. And the other thing I probably want to say right now is, on what part of a neuron do we have action potentials? We don't have action potentials over the whole neuron, only a certain part of it. Only the axon. And the other thing you should then relate to or tie into this concept is, why is it that an axon can have action potentials but not the cell body or dendrite? What's particular to that part of the cell? And if you want to think of the plasma membrane in that part of the cell, that's a nice hint. What does a plasma membrane have in an axon of a neuron that is not found in the soma or a dendrite? These voltage-gated channels, that's right, the voltage-gated channels. Okay. They cannot summit. Yeah, I'm going to talk about that right now, as a matter of fact. Okay, thanks for asking. All right, so there is a part of an action. Let's go back to this action potential. All right, why does this sodium current stop right here? Why does the sodium current stop? Because we got these inactivation gates. Okay, they slam this voltage-gated channel closed and stop that sodium current. Right, where does that happen? Right here, pretty much at the peak of the action potential. All right, and since that channel now is plugged up, guess what cannot happen? It can't get stimulated again because that sodium channel is now closed forever until that inactivation gate changes or opens up or gets out of the way. All right, so this last question right here was, action potentials cannot summate. Right, we can't put one action potential on top of another one because right at this point in time right here, the inactivation gate closes and that prevents another depolarization from occurring. We call that a refractory period, and as a matter of fact, we call that an absolute refractory period. Two action potentials can't exist on top of each other at the same time because of that absolute refractory period. All right, so right where I have the cursor at the peak of the action potential, don't forget those sodium channels are now inactivated, and that prevents that neuron from being stimulated again. So that's why. Cannot summate because, and if I were going to fill in this blank right here, I would say because of the absolute refractory period. And that absolute refractory period occurs because of the inactivation gate. Okay, now here is something kind of interesting. We said that action potentials, in terms of their amplitude, how does it change with stimulus intensity? It doesn't change, same amplitude all the time. But in your everyday experience, can you tell the difference between a stimulus that's really soft and a stimulus that's really loud? Is there a difference? Can your brain appreciate differences in intensity? So the question is, how is it that your brain can appreciate changes of intensity when an action potential is exactly the same? And that's how your brain thinks. Your brain thinks in terms of action potentials. That's the only thing that it can respond to. So if I were to just kind of speak in English, what an action potential sounds like to your brain is what? I don't have a time scale here. Here's a time scale. An action potential lasts for, okay, just about 1 or 2 milliseconds. It's something that's very, very fast. Right? So your brain hears an action potential as a blip. All right, so that's how your brain understands all stimuli, as just a blip or a sequence of blips. And I can't talk to you in blip language very well. Okay, but your brain is always thinking in blip, 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 or blip, blip, blip. But what about the intensity of these blips? Exactly constant. Every blip has the same amplitude. All right, so how can you appreciate different intensities of any particular stimulus? Well, let's look at this graph right here. So we have a couple plots. We have membrane potential versus time on the top plot, and the second one we have stimulus strength versus time. All right, so we have these two different graphs, and we're going to compare them. The first graph right here, I don't see any action potentials, but the lower graph I see, oh, well, somebody turned the stimulus on and off, but it's not producing action potentials. How would you explain that? It didn't reach threshold. That's a pretty easy concept, right? It's got to reach, what, that minus 60 millivolts before those voltage-gated channels open up on, or the axon hillock, for instance, or someplace on an axon. All right, and if we increase the stimulus, all right, guess what happens? We can get some action potentials. All right, and you can see these action potentials all have the same duration, the same amplitude, and the same distance between them. So what do we have right here? We've got a blip, 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 blip. That signals to your brain a particular modality of sensation at a particular intensity. The intensity is related by the distance between the action potentials, And we just call that the frequency of action potentials. This one is relatively slow. The frequency of these action potentials reaching the brain is relatively slow because this stimulus here is relatively weak. Right? Even though it's a constant stimulus, right, why can't this constant stimulus produce another action potential right in this location, right where I in time, right where I have the cursor right here? Okay. Because of the concept of refractory period once again. Let me see if I have it on the next slide. Yeah, this is a pretty good slide. It's drawn pretty well. All right, so there are two kinds of refractory periods in a neuron. There's an absolute refractory period, right, which is determined by the inactivation gate, and this slide I think is a little bit off. When does that inactivation gate, when does the inactivation gate become activated? I hate to phrase it that way. Well, when does the inactivation gate take effect? At the peak of the action potential. So it really starts right here, right? So I don't know why they colored this part of the action potential. Right, so the absolute refractory period starts right here. That's when the inactivation gate closes. Right, and then when that membrane protein reaches resting membrane potential, that inactivation gate, right, now opens up. So at this point in time, another action potential actually can be instituted in that neuron. But sometimes it doesn't happen because of this relative refractory period. So here we have an area of hyperpolarization. All right, so now let's consider this hyperpolarization. What, and let's just for fun, what is this area of hyperpolarization due to? Potassium. Yeah, it's a slow potassium channel. It just haven't been closed yet all the way, right, because they're just slow. All right, so if we come along with the same threshold stimulus, all right, so if we go, what would be a threshold stimulus from minus 70 to 55 is what? 15 millivolts. So if we have a 15 millivolt stimulus, apply that stimulus when a cell is at RMP, that will reach threshold. But what about in this period of time right here? If we now come back with the same stimulus, a 15 millivolt stimulus, will it reach threshold? No. It won't reach threshold. So therefore, we say that this is a relative refractory period. All right, so if we put, what does this look like? Maybe say minus 80. Let's just say this is minus 80. And if we come along with a 15 millivolt stimulus, that will take us from 80 to 70 to 65. But that doesn't reach threshold because threshold is at 55. So an action potential won't occur, even though the stimulus is exactly the same. Right? We would talk about that stimulus as being a sub-threshold stimulus because of this relative refractory period. Right? And now, another action potential won't occur if it's a 15 millivolt stimulus that we leave on. See, we leave it on this whole period of time right here. When will another action potential take place? Only when the membrane potential goes back to the resting membrane potential will that trigger another action potential, because that 15 millivolt stimulus will now reach threshold. And what will happen when the stimulus reaches threshold? Action potential, right, those voltage-gated sodium channels open up, sodium rushes into the cell, right, and that's going to trigger another action potential after this relative refractory period. All right, so you might have to flip back and forth to look at this previous slide and this absolute refractory period, that relative refractory period. All right, well, now let's look at the third circumstance right here. Now, let's just say that we have a very strong stimulus, right? It's just not threshold. It's above threshold. And let's relate it to this relative refractory period. So now we have, in time, an area of the cell that's hyperpolarized, but now we have a super strong stimulus. It can overcome, right, the relative refractory period plus move the membrane towards zero to reach threshold. So if there is a supra-threshold stimulus, it can overcome this refractory period. And then we have an action potential taking place right here. All right, so can you see that there's a difference in time depending on the strength of the stimulus? All right, so the first case, when it was just threshold, you had to wait until after the relative refractory period. But if it's a really strong stimulus, that can trigger an action potential even during the relative refractory period. It can overcome this area of hyperpolarization. Oop, wrong way. So when the stimulus is stronger, in this third case, what can you tell me about the amplitude of these action potentials? They're all the same. What about the duration or the width of each one of these? Exactly the same. But now what about the frequency? How many per time? Many more for the same period of time. We got 4 versus what do we got there? Probably like 10. All right, so we call this frequency coding. All right, so stimulus intensity changes your perception by frequency coding, just the number of action potentials per time that reach a particular area of the brain. All right, so if you're hearing a relatively weak signal, the action potential going to your auditory cortex is going to sound like a blip, blip, blip. But if it's a very loud sound, the action potentials reaching that part of the brain are going to do what? Who could tell me? Yeah, it's going to be a lot faster. Same amplitude, same duration, but it's going to be what? Blip, 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 blip. Bigger intensity, right? So that's how your brain interprets intensity as a change in frequency of these action potentials. Okay, and that's due to what? These different refractory periods of voltage-gated channels. All right, so let's switch now our attention to a different part of the cell. All right, we were just talking about an axon that has voltage-gated channels. And so we like to think of the axon as being the sending part of a neuron. It's sending information. All right, how is information being sent by an axon? How is it being sent? Okay, information is being sent from the axon hillock all the way down to the axon terminus. But how's that information getting there? How's it getting there? Does somebody like write a note and it's being transferred down the exoplasm or what? It's being transmitted as electrically as what? The changes in voltage on the membrane of the axon. What do we call it when that voltage changes? Action potential. Yeah, so it's just an action potential traveling down an axon. And commonly, what do we call that action potential as it's in motion down an axon? That is a nerve impulse. Right, so a nerve impulse is how information is transmitted along an axon, and that's just an action potential or a series of action potentials down an axon. All right, the other parts of a neuron, like the dendrite and cell body, don't have voltage-gated channels, so they cannot transmit action potentials. They can only transmit regular kinds of electrical signals. Right, because they have other kinds of channels in the membrane that we're going to call ligand-gated channels. All right, so these channels open and close not because of a change of voltage across the membrane, but because there's a signaling molecule that's actually going to bind to a receptor protein on the plasma membrane. And we call that a ligand-gated channel. So now let's consider a dendrite or a cell body. And if we inject some kind of positive current into, as a matter of fact, I don't even like this axon right here. I really want you to relate this to a dendrite or a cell body. But if we inject some kind of positive current into this cell, that positive current is going to move through the cell, through the dendrite and the cell body, and there's some resistance to that flow of electricity. Some of the electricity can leak out of the cell. And if we were to measure with an electrode at the tip of a dendrite what the signal looks like, we see a signal right here, right? There's a depolarization and then it fades away. And then if we put another electrode maybe at the base of the dendrite or on the cell body someplace, what happens to that signal as it flows over the dendrite and over the cell body? Is the amplitude the same? Okay, notice that it changes. It kind of disappears, kind of like the ringing of a bell, right? There's a signal and then it dies away as it moves over a dendrite or the cell body. So this kind of potential is, would you call this an action potential? Would you call that an action potential? What's the hallmark of an action potential in terms of amplitude? It's exactly the same. The amplitude for an action potential is exactly the same at the beginning of an axon compared to the end of an axon. But for this kind of potential, right, this is a potential right here, it dies away over the distance that it's traveling. So since it's dying away, we call that a graded potential, right? And it's dying away because of resistance to flow of electricity, and sometimes electricity can leak out of the cell. So a graded potential can travel over a nerve cell, but as it's traveling, what happens to its intensity? It slowly dies away. Just like if you were to ring a bell and you don't ring it again, then the intensity dies away, right? Kind of just exponentially like this. All right, so that is a graded potential. This is due to ligand-gated channels. And where do we find ligand-gated channels? Dendrites and cell bodies. So the neuron has to put different membrane proteins in the plasma membrane in different locations depending on whether it's the soma, the dendrite, or the cell body. And that's why I really like this one diagram. Let me see the diagram. The one that a student drew for us. Oh, yeah, sorry about that. Pull it out and I'll show that to you. I'll draw this on the board if we have time today or maybe tomorrow sometime. All right, here's just a hand-drawn diagram of a neuron. All right, so this is something that you can use to integrate up all of your knowledge about a particular neuron. We're just kind of sort of scratching the surface right at the moment. All right, so I see dendrites and cell body, and then I see an axon. So on this axon, what kind of membrane proteins do you have on the axon? Voltage-gated channels, and on dendrites and the soma right here, we have ligand-gated channels. So there, and the ligand-gated channel, in order for it to open up, has to bind a signaling molecule. All right, when a signaling molecule binds to that protein, it opens up. That causes depolarization. And so dendrites and cell body are what we call the receiving end of a neuron, or the receiving part, because it's receiving signals, namely chemical signals, that will change the electrical properties of the dendrite and cell body. All right. The axon is the sending part of a neuron because it has voltage-gated channels, so it can send action potentials without decrement. All right, now what about the graded potentials? How is a graded potential transmitted over a dendrite or a cell body? With decrement or without decrement? With decrement. It actually decreases as it travels over the dendrite and cell body. Okay, and that's due to the different kinds of protein channels that are in the membrane of those two particular parts of the cell. All right, and we're going to learn a lot about ligand-gated channels in a couple slides. All right, so let's talk about, and finish up with an action potential a little bit. All right, so here we have a nice axon, and we see some sodium entering the cell. What's that going to do to the electrical properties of the cell? Is it going to do anything to the electrical properties of the cell? What can you tell me about? Yeah, it's going to cause depolarization, right? And so depolarization is what? A stimulus to the cell. All right, so this part of an axon is depolarizing, right? And so guess what happens to this neighboring part of the axon right here? As this part depolarizes, so does this next part, right? It depolarizes a little bit, and when it reaches threshold, what happens? Then an action potential starts right here. And when an action potential starts right here, right, you have this big sodium current, and then what happens to this part of the axon? It slowly starts to depolarize, and when it reaches threshold, what happens? You get an action potential over here. So we're seeing what? An action potential moving down an axon due to voltage-gated channels in the plasma membrane of an axon. And then following depolarization, what happens? Well, you got repolarization. Okay? So this is how an action potential actually moves down an axon, because you have these voltage-gated channels for sodium and potassium, and when one area depolarizes, that causes the next distal segment of this axon to depolarize, which institutes an action potential, which then depolarizes the next area, which then depolarizes the next area. So an action potential can move without decrement down the whole length of this axon down to an axon terminus right here. Okay. All right, so this motion or this nerve impulse conduction is maybe relatively slow. It goes at about 2 miles per hour. Well, that's kind of slow. All right, but there is a specialization in most neurons in our bodies because there are neuroglia cells that surround axons. Now, what do we call these neuroglia cells? Tell me something about this chemical that's actually laying down insulation around the axon. First, tell me the names of the cells. Schwann cells, where do you find those? PNS. Another name of a cell would be? Oligodendrocyte in central nervous system. And what's the name of the chemical? Myelin, and it's a lipid, right? So that is a hydrophobic molecule that prevents sodium from entering or leaving this segment of the axon right here. Right? Furthermore, there are no voltage-gated channels underneath this wrapping underneath the myelin sheath right here. So again, that prevents sodium currents. But remember, there are gaps between Schwann cells. And in these gaps, I tell you what's the name of this gap? Node of Ranvier. So there are voltage-gated channels for sodium and potassium. So depolarization can happen here, and can happen here, and can happen here. Right? And when this area depolarizes, starting an action potential in this region right here, at a distance, a far distance, on the other side of this Schwann cell, that produces enough of a voltage change, depolarization, to reach threshold. So what happens to that action potential? Does it flow over from molecule to molecule to molecule? Or what does it do when an axon is myelinated? It actually hops, yeah, or jumps from one node of Ranvier to the next, to the next, to the next. And what that does for us in everyday life is that speeds up the nerve impulse or the rate of transmission of an action potential down an axon. All right, so instead of being 2 miles per hour, it can reach 300 miles per hour when an axon is myelinated because of the hopping of this signal right here. All right, so that's the importance of myelinated fibers is what? They're very fast. They can conduct electrical impulses very quickly because action potentials do what down an axon? They actually hop, right? They actually hop down an axon. All right, so let's just say that we were all in good enough shape to do this particular exercise. Here we have a flight of stairs, all right? And let's have a race up these flight of stairs. And we'll do it twice. The first time, we would have to step on every stair as we're going up and time ourselves. All right, so that's pretty strenuous. But the second race will be, how about now, let's step on every third stair on the way up. So we don't have to step on every one. We can jump from one to the three above it. Which way would be faster? If you had to step on every single one, or if you could skip two steps in between? Yeah, skipping is a lot faster than having to step on every stair, right? So this kind of conduction is what we call saltatory conduction, is what? Could be 10 to 100 times faster than the other kind of conduction, which is what we call, it's not on your slide right here, it's called continuous conduction. All right, so when an action potential skips from node of Ranvier to node of Ranvier, that's saltatory conduction. And what is that, fast or slow? Fast, as opposed to an action potential traveling molecule by molecule by molecule down an axon. That is relatively slow, and that's called continuous conduction. And I think we did mention last time how important it is to have myelinated nerve fibers, and a disease process that happens to some people where this myelination disappears or somehow degenerates in certain parts of their nervous system. We call that multiple sclerosis. And it just totally screws up, messes up the timing on how the brain or how different neurons communicate with each other inside a person's brain. Okay. All right, let's move on to another topic, synaptic transmission. All right, so don't miss next time because I'm going to review some of these concepts and maybe kind of put them all together for you next time. But a good thing to look at for next time is that hand drawing of a neuron. All right, so we're going to fill that in next time. Synaptic transmission. Well, what the heck is a synapse? What is a synapse? Yeah, synapse, probably all know, is like a space between neurons. Okay, but I want to change your understanding of it a little bit in terms of structural and functional unit. And I think in this class we talked about what's the structural and functional unit of life? The cell, right? If something is alive, it's got to be made out of cells. And so you got to know something about cells to know what life is all about. Let's see, where else did you learn structural and functional unit in anatomy? What's the structural and functional unit of urine formation? The nephron. Okay, a blast from the past. You have to know something about the nephron. What's the structural and functional unit of bone, for instance, compact bone? That's an osteon, right? So you got to know something about the proteins that make an osteon, the structure, the concentric lamellae, the cells that make it up. So it's a relatively complicated topic, but if you have that picture in your mind, you pretty much know a lot about compact bone, or life, or urine formation, or what else? Muscle contraction. We're going to talk about that in here too. What's a structural and functional unit of muscle contraction? That's a sarcomere, right? So that says a lot of stuff all in one sentence. Well, the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. That's what we're going to talk about right now. The structural and functional unit of communication is called the synapse. All right? And there are two main kinds of synapses in the body. There are chemical synapses that use chemicals, which we call neurotransmitters, and then there are electrical synapses that use currents, like sodium currents. Sodium is an ion, and when it's in motion, that's an electrical current. So those are electrical synapses. But anyway, this is how cells communicate with each other, how they pass information from one neuron to the next. All right, so let me just read this slide. Synapse is a functional connection between a neuron and another cell, which could be another neuron, maybe a muscle cell, for instance. And when information is transmitted from one cell to another, we just call that synaptic transmission. Chemical synapses use chemical signals that we call neurotransmitters, and electrical synapses use currents, like sodium currents. Electrical synapses are relatively rare in the body. Okay, and in order for an electrical signal to move from one cell into the other, right, namely maybe through a sodium current, sodium can't get through the plasma membrane, so there have to be special channels that allow for the diffusion of sodium from one cell, here's the first cell, into the second cell over here. And when sodium is at a high concentration in this top cell and it enters the bottom cell, what happens to the bottom cell when sodium enters the bottom cell? What is your now classical understanding of when sodium enters the cell? It's depolarization. And does that inhibit the cell or does that stimulate the cell? That stimulates the cell, because depolarization is what? A stimulus to the cell. So sodium moves through these channels, but we call these special channels gap junctions. And there are certain tissues in the body that have gap junctions. Some neurons do, very, very few. Some smooth muscle does, but a good example of where you find gap junctions is in cardiac muscle. Okay, so if you stimulate one cardiac muscle cell, what happens to the whole heart, and is that a really good thing? Yeah, if you depolarize one cell, that sodium flows from one cell to the next through what kind of special structures that you find in cardiac muscle? Yeah, the intercalated discs, and those intercalated discs, one component of an intercalated disc are these gap junctions right here. Right? So why is that a good thing? Why don't you want one cell in your heart to contract while the others are relaxing? Well, it's not going to pump any blood, right? So the whole heart has to contract as a unit to eject blood from the heart to maintain your blood pressure. Now, as opposed to skeletal muscle, let's just say we stimulate the biceps right here, and the biceps is connected to all the other skeletal muscles in your body by gap junctions. You tell your biceps to contract, what's going to happen? Well, your whole body's going to contract, right? Would that be very handy? Not really say I need a drink for my water bottle. I reached for my water bottle and what happens? Totally spastic, right? That would not work. You would have no control. That's really a definition of spasticity, okay? Okay, when you don't have control over your skeletal muscles because they contract too much. All right, so electrical synapses you find in the heart. You want your heart to contract as a unit, but that's not how everything is going to work in your body. That would not be the proper way. Now let's look at a chemical synapse. All right, so you do have electrical activity. Well, I see two cells. Let me describe this slide a little bit. I see two cells, the one on the top, one on the bottom, but we're not going to label them like that. All right, the one on the top comes before the synapse, before the junction, and then the one on the bottom is a cell that comes after the junction right here. So we call this the presynaptic neuron, and the bottom one we call the postsynaptic neuron, and in between them we have a synapse, and the synapse is going to have a number of components to it. Okay. So on this axon terminus, or the terminal end of this axon, we got an action potential coming down, and you have a picture in your mind of what an action potential is, right? It's just a change in the voltage across the cell membrane. It's going to go from minus 70, it's going to go positive, right, to about 30 millivolts or so. And there are special proteins, other special channels in the cell membrane at an axon terminus, and these channels are particular to calcium. And when the membrane depolarizes, these calcium channels open up. And guess what happens to calcium then? Going back to that first test, where is calcium at a high concentration? Inside or outside? It's outside the cell. So when those calcium channels open, you have this nice large calcium current entering the axon terminus. And now this is going to activate something inside the cell. So what kind of channels are these right here? Are these ligand-gated channels or voltage-gated channels? And we haven't really looked at ligand-gated channels yet, I understand. But maybe you could answer that question anyway, because I said that they change their state from closed to open when the voltage changes across the membrane. So that is a voltage-gated channel. So these calcium channels are voltage-gated. They open up. Calcium enters. That activates a protein that we call calmodulin. So calcium binds to calmodulin. So calmodulin just stands for calcium that is going to modulate something or change the activity of something. It's going to change the activity of a protein kinase. Ooh, what's a protein kinase? It's an enzyme, right? ASE, it's an enzyme. What is the activity of that enzyme? It's going to add a phosphate to something, right? And the phosphate that's added to something else, what's going to happen to that something else? It's going to change its activity, right? We've changed the structure of that protein, so it's going to change its function. That's like doing what to you? Somebody poking you in the side, right? It's going to change, and it's going to become active. All right, so protein kinase runs around phosphorylating a bunch of regulatory proteins inside the cell, and that's all due to what? This calcium entering the cell. And then that's going to cause these vesicles, which contain neurotransmitter, right, so we call these synaptic vesicles. It's going to cause these vesicles to move, hop a ride on some microtubules to the, here's a membrane. Is that a presynaptic membrane or a postsynaptic membrane? That's the presynaptic membrane. So these vesicles are going to dock and fuse to the membrane, and then they're going to exocytose neurotransmitter into this space, which we call the synaptic cleft. And so here you have high concentration of neurotransmitter by the postsynaptic membrane. You have low concentration. So what does that mean for a neurotransmitter? You got a concentration, high to low. What's going to happen? It's going to move. It's going to diffuse across the synaptic cleft by diffusion. And in the postsynaptic membrane, there are going to be receptor proteins that can bind the neurotransmitter. Right, and then that's going to change the activity of the postsynaptic cell, thereby carrying information across the synapse. So you might say, well, how come this action potential can't just hop over the synaptic cleft right here and stimulate directly the postsynaptic cell? And that's because there's just way too much resistance to electrical signals in the synapse. Electricity could hop from one nerve to the other, All right? If it was like a lightning bolt. But do you have lightning bolts running around inside your body? No, you don't. Okay? So that's the level of, we're talking what, millivolts, not thousands of volts, right? In order to get a shock from somebody, that has to be thousands of volts to get electricity to hop over a big space. All right, so this is the basis of a synapse. You've got the presynaptic cell, postsynaptic cell, and the signal that enters the cell that causes release of neurotransmitter is due to calcium. All right, so calcium ion is necessary for synaptic transmission or the transmission of information from the pre to the postsynaptic cell. All right, I think we just talked about all this. All right, well, what can you tell me about calcium? Where is it important in your body? Bones. It's real important for bone strength so that bones don't compress. All right, but what else do you know about calcium ions right now? What else is it important for? Well, we haven't talked about that, but yeah, you're right. It's important for muscles. We will talk about it. But for synaptic transmission, for neurons communicating with each other. So without the proper levels of calcium in your extracellular space, neurons can't communicate with each other, and that would be like having a dead brain. All right, so where do you think it's more important to have calcium? In your bones or in the extracellular space so that neurons can communicate with each other? If you had to pick one or the other, right, of course you'd want to say, well, both, right? But if you had to pick one or the other, would you pick bones or for synaptic transmission? Synaptic transmission, right? So that's kind of the underlying, one of the underlying processes of osteoporosis. You might wonder, well, how come we suffer from osteoporosis? Well, because there's many other important mechanisms that require calcium, and one of the least important is having strong bones. So when you run low on calcium, where does your body get calcium from? From bones, right? To put in the extracellular space. Okay. All right, so neurotransmitter release is due to activation of calmodulin. And you're kind of familiar, maybe from anatomy, with a molecule that's similar to calmodulin. All right, somebody mentioned muscle up over here. Ooh, but we haven't talked about this in the class. But there is a protein in muscle that binds calcium, okay, which we're going to talk about. Can anybody go way back in their past and remember a molecule that can bind calcium in muscle that changes how a muscle is functioning? How about troponin? I don't know if troponin is ringing a bell, but troponin and calmodulin are like cousin molecules because they can bind calcium and it's going to change the metabolism inside the cell. So for a synapse, it's going to cause release of neurotransmitter. But in a muscle cell, when calcium binds to troponin, what's going to happen to that muscle cell? It's going to shorten or contract, right? We'll expand on that when we get to muscle. Okay. Well, let's still consider synaptic transmission. Okay. I really want to get to, this is a pretty good picture of a cell right here. What do I want to talk about? Graded potentials. Okay, that's all I'll talk about when we look at this slide right here. So we see dendrites and cell body, and then we have an axon. What kind of membrane proteins do we have in an axon that allow for action potentials? Voltage-gated channels. Right? We don't have any voltage-gated channels on dendrites and cell bodies. We have a different kind of channel that opens and closes. It's not due to a voltage change across the membrane. It's due to binding of a molecule to a receptor. And we call that a ligand-gated channel. So on dendrites and cell body, we have ligand-gated channels. Axons, we have voltage-gated channels. So in order to produce electrical signals on dendrites and the cell body, a ligand has to bind to a receptor, and it's going to change the cell membrane because it's going to open up a sodium channel, for instance. Sodium is going to enter the cell. What happens to the cell when sodium enters? It depolarizes, and is that excitatory or inhibitory? It's excitatory. So when a sodium channel opens up, that's going to produce, right, something that we call an EPSP. That's an excitatory postsynaptic potential, right? Because what cell is this right here? Is this the presynaptic cell or postsynaptic cell? The red one is the presynaptic, and this yellow one is the postsynaptic. So when the red one releases neurotransmitter, binds to a ligand-gated channel, it opens up, allows sodium to enter the cell, and that's going to cause depolarization, a little bit of depolarization. That's what we call an excitatory postsynaptic potential, because this is what? The postsynaptic cell right here. That's excitatory. That's going to drive this cell closer and closer to threshold when sodium enters the cell. Okay. There's another kind of potential that can develop as well. Some neurons release ligands that don't open sodium channels, but they might open potassium channels. What's going to happen to the membrane potential of this, of the postsynaptic cell, if a potassium channel opens up instead of a sodium? Potassium will leak out. All right, and what, relate that to an action potential. As sodium is leaving the cell, what happens to membrane potential? Does it get more polar or less polar? Less polar meaning, does it go up to zero or does it drift farther away from zero? We call that polarization or hyperpolarization. When potassium leaves, the cell hyperpolarizes. And does it move closer or farther away from threshold? So my left hand will be threshold. If we hyperpolarize the membrane, what happens to it? It drops below the threshold. So now what kind of stimulus do you need to reach threshold? A lesser stimulus or a greater stimulus? A greater stimulus. So what is happening to the cell when it hyperpolarizes or when potassium leaves? Is it excited or is it inhibited? It's inhibited because now it needs a greater stimulus to reach threshold. Right? So when a potassium channel opens, we call that an IPSP, or an inhibitory postsynaptic potential, because the membrane potential is hyperpolarizing. All right, so what part of this neuron can have EPSPs or IPSPs? Is it the axon or is it dendrites and cell body? It's going to be the dendrite and cell body, because that's where you have these ligand-gated channels that can bind a neurotransmitter that's coming from another cell. All right, so a neurotransmitter can produce an EPSP, it can excite the cell, or it can produce an IPSP if it's going to inhibit the cell right here. All right, so let's look at these right here. All right, so a neurotransmitter is just another name for a ligand. Right, that's the molecule that's going to diffuse across the synaptic cleft, and we're going to learn a number of different kinds of neurotransmitters. Anybody have an idea of some names of neurotransmitters? Acetylcholine, good example. Another example would be norepinephrine, serotonin, and there's some amino acids that are neurotransmitters. Actually, I think I gave you a list on maybe the second chapter. Glycine, okay, can be used as a neurotransmitter. All right, and a neurotransmitter can only affect the postsynaptic cell if it has what? Say we release acetylcholine on a nerve cell, and it will be sensitive to acetylcholine, or maybe it's going to be insensitive to it. What makes a neuron sensitive to acetylcholine if we drop acetylcholine on it? It's got to have a receptor that is on the outside of the cell, because acetylcholine can't get inside the cell. There's got to be a receptor that binds acetylcholine. Hence, we call those channels ligand-gated channels. They actually have to bind the neurotransmitter. Okay, so that's going to open that regulated ion channel, which we call a ligand-gated channel. All right, if it causes depolarization, for instance, if it's a sodium channel, it's going to produce an EPSP, but if it's a ligand-gated channel that causes hyperpolarization, what kind of channel is going to cause hyperpolarization? Potassium, okay? And if it hyperpolarizes, that's going to produce an IPSP. It's going to inhibit the cell. It's going to drive it farther away from threshold. Okay. So these EPSPs and IPSPs are, well, there's two different kinds of potentials that you're aware of right now. Actually, there's three. There's resting membrane potential, where nothing changes. But then there's two kinds of potentials where something's changing. What are the two kinds of potentials? You've got graded potential and action potential, where the voltage is changing, right? Which kind dies away over time? Graded potentials, right? And which kind travel without degradation? That's the action potential. Okay. So ligand-gated channels produce graded potentials. Right? And now you know two kinds of graded potentials, EPSPs and IPSPs. And an action potential is never EPSP or IPSP. It's just what? It's always excitatory. And it's used for transmitting information down an axon over long distances. All right, so EPSPs and IPSPs are due to ligand-gated channels. And where do you find ligand-gated channels? Dendrites and cell body, that's where we find them. All right. Graded potentials are variable in amplitude. They're big. They're high in amplitude when they get instituted at a ligand-gated channel, but as they flow over the dendrite and cell body, they decrease in amplitude. All right, so they propagate with decrement. But the interesting thing about graded potentials, which action potentials cannot accomplish, is that they can summate. All right, so graded potentials can add to each other or they can subtract from each other. In the case of if you have two EPSPs on one neuron, they will add to each other. But if you have one neuron that is producing EPSPs and another neuron that's producing IPSPs, what are they going to do? They're going to cancel each other out, right? One is causing depolarization, the other is causing hyperpolarization, and when they join together, they will cancel each other out. Okay, so graded potentials can summate, they can add or subtract from each other. All right, so here is a little flow diagram of synaptic transmission. Let's see. All right, so we have two neurons symbolized by these two boxes right here. You've got the presynaptic neuron and the postsynaptic neuron in the box below it. You've got an action potential being conducted by what part of the presynaptic neuron? It's got to be the axon because it has, what does an axon have once again? Voltage-gated channels. So that's going to transmit an action potential without decrement down the whole length of the axon. And when it reaches the axon terminal, what does that action potential do? It causes depolarization of the axon terminus, which then opens up a voltage-gated calcium channel, right, because there's a big membrane potential change at the axon terminus. That's going to open up a calcium channel. And what does calcium do? It can now get across the plasma membrane at the axon terminus because the calcium channel opens up. Which way is it going to go, in or out? It's going to go in because high calcium on the outside of the cell, low calcium on the inside. And that's going to be the signal for releasing neurotransmitter because calcium binds to calmodulin. A number of proteins are going to be phosphorylated as a result of that, changing their function. So synaptic vesicles will fuse to the membrane, releasing neurotransmitter into the, oh, what's this area right here? That's the synaptic cleft in your mind's eye someplace, right? Synaptic cleft. And the neurotransmitter then is going to bump into the postsynaptic membrane or postsynaptic neuron. And if this postsynaptic neuron has something special, that neurotransmitter can change the behavior of this postsynaptic cell. What does it have to have? It's got to have a receptor, right? And how do you describe the relationship between a ligand and a receptor? Lock and key model, hand and glove, but they have to have a complementary shape. So if my right hand is a ligand, right, the receptor has to have the right shape so that it can bind the ligand. And when it binds the ligand, that opens up, could be a couple different kinds of channels. If it's a sodium channel, what's going to happen to the postsynaptic cell? If it's a sodium ligand-gated channel, it's going to depolarize the cell. That is what? A stimulus. We call that an EPSP. All right, so that's going to cause a graded potential to flow over the dendrite and the cell body. But as it flows, what happens to it? It dies off. But if it reaches the axon hillock and it's still at a threshold, what's going to happen? Action potential at the axon hillock, which is going to proceed down the axon. Okay. But if the greater potential dies away below threshold by the time it gets to the axon hillock, what's going to happen to that action potential possibly at the axon? Nothing is, it's just going to die right there. Okay? Okay, so every neuron acts as an integration center. It can make up its mind whether or not it's going to start an action potential at the axon hillock based on the kinds of EPSPs as well as IPSPs that have started on its dendrites and cell body. So every neuron acts like a little logic circuit. All right, I need to talk a little bit about some ligand-gated channels. All right, so we said acetylcholine is an important neurotransmitter. It's the most widely used. Right? It's used in the brain, autonomic nervous system, and all skeletal muscles. So every skeletal muscle before it contracts has to be stimulated by acetylcholine. And there are actually a couple different major classes of receptors for acetylcholine. There are some that are called nicotinic, and there are some that are called muscarinic. So these are two major subtypes. All right? And some can be excitatory and some can be inhibitory. So if it's excitatory, what kind of channel is opening up?
Sodium.
And if it's inhibitory, what kind of channel is opening up? Potassium. Right. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at this slide right here. Here we see a nice phospholipid bilayer, or what? Cell membrane, for instance. Here is a nice membrane protein that spans the whole membrane. It goes from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell. And this is a channel because sometimes it's closed and sometimes it's open. And the controlling signal as to whether or not this protein is going to be open or closed is going to be determined by whether or not these binding sites for a ligand are bound or not. All right, so here we have a little binding site for acetylcholine. And we see that for this kind of channel, it needs to bind to acetylcholine molecules. And when it does, it changes shape because it's like somebody poking it in the side. Right? The channel opens up, and in particular, sodium enters the cell. All right, so this particular kind of receptor or ligand-gated channel is what we call a nicotinic receptor. It binds two acetylcholines. It's going to open up, and predominantly sodium is going to enter the cell. And when sodium enters the cell, is that producing an IPSP or an EPSP? EPSP, because that's going to cause depolarization. And that's going to drive the cell membrane up toward threshold. All right, so this is the typical nicotinic kind of acetylcholine receptor. We're familiar with G-protein coupled receptors, and this is where I'm going to start next time, with this one right here. Maybe you should go back and review what you had on the first test for a G-protein coupled receptor. Okay, because this is where we're going to start next time.